It was a deadly weekend on Montana's roads. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetic.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Reporter Ruth Eddy has a reminder that it's not too late to get ready for fire season. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with the State Labor Commissioner Pam Busey about closing the wage gap between Montana women and men. A 59-year-old Blackfoot Valley man died in a one-vehicle rollover crash on Montana 200 near Ovando. Missoula County Sheriff Sergeant Jeremiah Peterson says several drivers called 911 around 10 a.m. yesterday to report a sport utility vehicle driving erratically. Not long after that, the SUV went off the road, landing with its back bumper in the Blackfoot River. The driver died at the scene. As of this evening, KPAX released the name of the Ovando man to be Michael John Murphy. The crash was one of four in western Montana over the weekend that claimed 11 lives.
And in other news from around the state, Montana State Prison inmate Barry Beach says he will continue to fight to prove his innocence in the 1979 killing of Kim Neese of Poplar, but his efforts will be made from behind bars. Beach was released from prison in December 2011 after a state judge ordered a new trial in his case. Last month, the Montana Supreme Court overturned that decision. Beach has asked the Supreme Court to reconsider. The state responded Thursday, arguing the decision to deny a new trial is correct. Retired District Judge E. Wayne Phillips says he feared he had done, quote, a soul-wrenching injustice, unquote, to Beach in freeing him, only to have him return to prison. Beach told the Great Falls Tribune he doesn't regret the freedom and opportunity that Judge Phillips gave him.
A judge has approved medical testing for Wyoming's lone death row inmate to determine whether he should be covered by a federal ban against executing people with intellectual disabilities. Dale Wayne Eaton is challenging the constitutionality of the state death sentence he received in the 1988 rape and murder of 18-year-old Lisa Marie Kimmel of Billings, Montana. U.S. District Judge Alan B. Johnson approved a request from Eaton's lawyers today for testing to determine whether he has intellectual disabilities that would preclude putting him to death. Johnson plans a hearing this summer on Eaton's claim that his original defense team didn't develop, quote, mitigation evidence. Such evidence would have been information about Eaton's past that underscored his humanity to try to convince the jury not to sentence him to death.
Federal and state officials will weigh in this week in a Wyoming company's application to lease a 198 million tons of coal adjacent to southeastern Montana mine. Cloud Peak Energy is seeking to expand its lease at the Spring Mine near Decker by more than 1,600 acres. Wednesday's initial decision on the application comes on the heels of an inspector general's report that said the Interior Department is potentially losing tens of millions of dollars by undervaluing coal from public lands. Environmentalists want a moratorium on new releases. The coal industry says its critics are ignoring billions of dollars in government revenues from mining. The Bureau of Land Management said today that it would be several years before a value was released on the lease sought by Cloud Peak.
Drivers on Montana's highways now have a new number to call for non-emergency safety or traffic concerns. The Montana Highway Patrol still wants people to call 911 for life-threatening situations, but all other calls can be placed with a brand new toll-free dispatch number. Montana Attorney General Deputy Communications Director Anastasia Burton says the Highway Patrol decided to change its decades-old dispatch number for financial reasons.
There was a dramatic increase in the charge for keeping the old number, so we did some checking around with different carriers and were able to find a new carrier who was able to provide us with a much greater savings each month. And so we switched to the new carrier, and in doing so, we also needed to switch the 1-800 number. The old charges were increasing to approximately $7,500 a month. The new carrier is estimated at charging about $800 a month, so that amounts to a significant annual savings for taxpayers.
Burton says there are appropriate situations to call the Highway Patrol dispatch number in situations in which 911 is the better alternative.
If you're in an emergency situation or you're witnessing an emergency situation, please go ahead and call 911. Doing so dials directly into local communication centers and it gets the EMS people moving faster. If you call the dispatch number, our dispatchers have to then contact the local sheriff's office, who in turn call EMS, and that slows down initial medical response a little bit. So some good examples of when to call the new dispatch number include seeing a stranded motorist, noticing hazardous road conditions, seeing debris on the highway, seeing something suspicious at a rest area, or witnessing intoxicated or dangerous drivers on the highway.
Burton says the new Highway Patrol dispatch number, which is 1-855-MHP-3777, has special significance.
We chose the new number as a nod back to the historic vigilantes. The numbers 3777 have been associated with them for many years. Lots of folks in Montana will remember that they are the people who cleaned up the gold camps here in the Helena area in 1864, and in doing so, they earned a place in history. And you'll notice now that those same numbers appear on the shoulder patch and car door insignias of our Highway Patrol.
Again, the new toll-free Montana Highway Patrol dispatch number is 1-855-MHP-3777. That's 1-855-647-3777.
An environmental group is suing federal water and wildlife agencies, contending that the agencies have long delayed taking the steps needed to protect Idaho's water quality. Northwest Environmental Advocate filed the lawsuit in Boise's U.S. District Court against the National Marine Fisheries Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on Friday. The environmental group claims that the federal agencies have dragged their feet for 17 years when it comes to requiring Idaho to protect its waters and aquatic species. The federal government is required to review water quality standards set by the states, and Idaho's Department of Environmental Quality submitted its proposed toxic standards to the Environmental Protection Agency for review in 1994. But the federal agencies in Idaho have yet to reach an agreement on the standards.
With the official start to summer just a few days away, Montanans are getting out their swimsuit and sunscreen, as well as preparing for smoke. Reporter Ruth Eddy spoke today with State Forester Bob Harrington about the fire season sure to arrive sometime in the next few weeks.
This is simply what we do, and it's just part of the natural season. We have hunting season, we have legislative seasons, we have training season, we have fire season.
Montana State Forester Bob Harrington isn't quite ready yet to call it fire season, but knows it's just a few weeks away.
We're just really thankful that for a lot of the state, we've been able to relax a little bit and focus on preparing for the season rather than responding to large wildfires, which is what we were doing this time last year.
This year's rainfall helped move the fire season back to a more normal start. With really good moisture statewide, Harrington expects fire activity to pick up around mid-July.
That's not to say that tomorrow there couldn't be a fire that starts somewhere in this state.
With the chance of fire ever present, fuel reduction methods like clearing brush, raking needles out of your gutters, and moving firewood away from the house are highly recommended. However, not without caution.
The conditions out there are such that using a chainsaw and doing a lot of activity out in the forest is not as risk-free as it is right now.
In areas of dry grass and vegetation, engaging in fuel reduction at this time could be more dangerous than helpful. Slash piles of branches and brush are now best disposed of by using a chipper. There are, of course, preparations for fire season that involve no risk,
which is to develop a plan as to what they're going to do if fire visits their neighborhood and they're under either an evacuation advisory or under an evacuation order.
Harrington recommends the web program Ready, Set, Go, which has checklists and tips built on years of experience with people in harm's way.
And of course, what we're trying to prevent is a situation like occurred on the Black Forest fire, where two people were actually killed in their garage with the doors of their car open, preparing to evacuate, but they were too late. Because what you've seen in the Black Forest fire in Colorado is what we saw last year, where the condition of weather, fuels, and topography just makes such extreme burning conditions that there's not a whole lot to be done at that point in time.
Harrington hopes the fires in Colorado will remind Montanans how at risk they are and motivate them into using the next 3 to 4 weeks to prepare as much as they can. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Ruth Eddy.
Resources for fire preparation can be found at your local fire department or online at montanafiresafe.org.
A Portland, Oregon man whose cat had been missing since last year will soon be reunited with a well-traveled feline, courtesy of the transient who's been caring for her for more than 9 months. Ron Buss says he let his cat, Mata-Hari, out of the house in September. The cat never returned. Michael King spotted the cat hiding under a table trying to stay out of the pouring rain. He tells the Independent Record that he didn't want a cat, but picked her up and to save her life. The cat traveled with King to California, back to Portland, and then out to Montana, where King's foster father lives. They took the cat to a veterinarian, found a microchip, and contacted the owner.
As we reported last week, Governor Steve Bullock has signed an executive order creating the Equal Pay for Equal Work Task Force. The task force will study why women earn less than men in Montana and make recommendations on how to close that gap. Nationally, women earn 77% of what men earn. In Montana, the gap is even wider, with women earning on average about $31,000 a year compared to about $42,000 for men, according to the Women's Foundation of Montana. The new task force will be co-chaired by the director of the State Department of Administration, Sheila Hogan, and by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, Pam Busey. In tonight's feature interview, Busey talks with News Director Sally Mock about why Montana has one of the highest gender wage disparities in the country.
Some of the things are that women are more likely to work part-time jobs. Women are more likely to take time off to care for their children or their adult elderly parents. So, you know, they take a break from the workforce, and what has happened is they just never recover from that.
What would be potential solutions to that?
There are some very definitive paid sick leave. You know, there is something that has demonstrated results. Women that get paid sick leave to have their children are much more likely, in the 90% more likely, to still be employed a year after the birth of their child. So there are definitely some remedies. Also, just policies for how you come in and out of the workforce. It shouldn't be, you should never not be able to recover. You know, you should still get some past credit for past employment. So I think there are some non-financial policy changes that could be made to make a big difference for women in Montana.
Outside of the child rearing and child bearing that come up in this issue, what else do you think?
Very surely we have women performing the same jobs as men being paid less. And that's unfortunate, but it's a fact. It's also how we have valued certain work. And a good example, folks who pick up your garbage, generally, you know, it's a heavy lifting job, you know, running equipment, those kinds of things. Those folks generally make, you know, $17 to $25 an hour to do garbage pickup. That's a traditionally male job. So folks that work in the intensive parts of hospitals, intensive support parts of hospitals, or intensive support parts of nursing home, very similar when analyzed kinds of job duties, lifting heavy, lifting large amounts. Running equipment, those kinds of things. So very similar kinds of job duties. The garbage delivery folks, those folks make minimum wage to $13 an hour. So, and that's a very female-dominated profession. So there is just some examples of straight across the board women in the same jobs as men getting paid less, and we have to identify those. But then there's some examples of just how we valued work that historically women do. And then there's, of course, the entering and re-entering the workforce issues.
Discrimination is something that certainly can be remedied if people take legal action or if it's made more of a priority, certainly. But how would you change those pay disparities in general? How would you change that?
Well, you know, I think education, again, and that's something, you know, I should have brought up. A lot of problems women have is we undervalue our work and we undervalue ourselves. We don't advocate for promotions. We don't negotiate for salaries. And there's a host of studies, new studies that have come out about the failure of women to actually negotiate for salaries, to do the research, to know what the job they're applying for traditionally make so that they can advocate for their own salaries and or flexibility or whatever it is that they need. So we do also need to educate women. There's a study that was recently published that demonstrated that women just graduating from college, applying for their first job, undervalue to the tune of $10,000 how much they're going to make at their first job. compared to their exact same age male counterparts. So there's certainly things that we can do as women to help ourselves as well, and I think that's about education and training. And so we have a lot of ideas. We have folks that are very interested in that part as well. But I also do think there are things happening. You know, the Equal Pay Act is one thing, but as you know, the Lilly Ledbetter Act, there's things just knowing how much you should get paid, and you should be able to know that. You know, you should be able to find out what people with the same job as you are making at your company so that you know, so you have some awareness of what you should be getting paid.
People are often afraid to ask.
Absolutely.
Even what their coworkers are being paid, and have no idea that someone might be being paid more for the same job.
That's absolutely correct, and that's something that we can change. People should be entitled to that information so they can make decisions about how to negotiate and how much they should be getting paid for, and they shouldn't suffer ramifications for asking that information, and companies shouldn't be able to prevent them from getting that information. And there are legitimate reasons that people get paid differently, but we should be able to know what those are, you know.
It sounds like, Commissioner Busey, that you agree with Sheryl Sandberg that women should lean in.
I absolutely do. I do. I loved the book, and I recommend it to everyone for no other reason than I've said I thought it was interesting sort of how the media has held her up against, you know, some of the more traditional institutional challenges that women faced. And I always thought she did such a good job of acknowledging this isn't what I'm talking about. You know, I'm talking about what we can do for ourselves, because these people are so good at talking about the institutional barriers to equal pay. I want to talk about something else. And so I just decided I don't really care, you know, about that fight so much, as long as the discussion keeps going so that, you know, people get more educated about this subject.
You excited about the task force? This is something that could make a difference.
I really am. I'm excited to work with Director Sheila Hogan. You know, we are both people, I think, who have a reputation for, you know, working through it, plodding through it, and getting things done. And I just the people, I can't even tell you how many people have asked to be involved in some capacity or another, have volunteered their time. I mean, economists, sociologists, all kinds of folks who are very interested in this issue. So I think there's a lot of interest. And I do think, you know, I mean, we need to understand the problem. We need to be able to quantify it. But I think there are some low-cost things we can do, and then I think we need to start the discussion about, you know, how we fix some of the bigger policy issues.
And it sounds like you're going to have about a year to work on this?
We hope to have the task force assembled in the next month. We're working with the governor on the membership of the task force to make sure, and again, I'm really committed to finding people who want to do work and who, you know, really want to dig in and find some, you know, implementable solutions. And then hopefully, I very much would like to, within the next year, get back to the governor with some real action steps, some concrete action steps that we can take that are supported by data.
Well, I've been speaking with State Labor Commissioner Pam Busey, who is also co-chair of the new Equal Pay for Equal Work Task Force. Commissioner Busey, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Sally, for having me.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight will be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and lows in the upper 40s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds, small hail, and heavy rainfall with highs in the 80s. For central Montana, tonight expect mostly cloudy skies in the evening with scattered showers. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds and small hail. For southwest Montana, tonight calls for mostly cloudy skies and isolated thunderstorms. Lows will be in the upper 40s. Tomorrow expect more clouds with a chance of rain showers through the day and into the evening. Some storms may have strong winds and small hail. Currently in our listening area, Helena is 76 degrees with partly cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's mostly cloudy and 77 degrees. Butte has 78 degrees under sunny skies. Great Falls is sunny with 85 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under partly cloudy skies is 85 degrees. It's 80 degrees and fair in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's sunny and 87 degrees. Libby has 79 degrees and sunny conditions. And in Polson, skies are partly cloudy and it's 83 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
one important justification for having an armed citizenry is to keep the government from having a monopoly on the means of violence. If the government has that advantage over its citizens, so the logic goes, there's nothing to keep the government from using its armed advantage to displace democracy with authoritarian rule. One of the major confounding arguments for giving the government the sole right to use force to settle disputes is that over the last several centuries, the development of strong governments that were vested with the exclusive right to use violence has been the primary source of the reduction in violence in our everyday lives. When governments were weak and did not have organized police forces, really a relatively recent invention, or standing armies, they had to raise armies as they planned military action, citizens were constantly threatened by a broad range of violent forces. There was a constant threat of armed brigands invading your farm, stealing your animals and stored food and money, and assaulting or even killing your family. In addition, the ruling nobility with their private armed forces could do more or less whatever they wanted to you and yours. Outlaws, mostly unattached armed young men, prowled the roads and populated the woods. Within communities, disputes between people or families were often settled with violence that could trigger years of revenge killings as clans fought clans over grievances from the distant past. With weak, decentralized, or non-existent government, people regularly settled conflicts and grievances by using violence themselves, individually or in groups. Religious zealots could mobilize group hysteria to hunt, torture, and kill heretics, sinners, witches, and people living unconventional lives. Male-dominated, honor-based cultures led to contests for honor, status, dominance, and glory outside of any legal structure. Violence was used to defend honor against perceived slights. The swelling and bruising of the male ego led to violent retaliation for perceived insults and the veneration of a man's violent abilities and capacities. Think of the repeated stories in Hollywood's version of the 19th century American West, or of the medieval clashes of knights, or the Japanese samurai defense of honor, or the practice of dueling over perceived slights to honor that stretched for centuries into the 19th century. Mob violence in the United States stretched well into the 20th century, imposing extra legal controls over African Americans long after they were legally freed from slavery. The point is that it was relatively strong governments that imposed the rule of law, that set up institutions to settle grievances and punish lawbreakers. That rule of law, in effect, gave the government the sole right to use deadly force, except in very limited circumstances, primarily immediate self-defense. The result was a dramatic decline in violence where effective, organized governments existed. In failed states, of course, the violent chaos continued and continues. It was also true that such strong governments, having monopolized the use of violence, could oppress citizens in intolerable ways. How is the citizenry to fight back in that situation if it is not also armed and free to use violence to resist? The answer to that was partially taught to us by Gandhi in his nonviolent struggle to end the British colonial control of his native India. Much of the European colonial empires disintegrated not because they were overpowered by indigenous armed force, but because of the nonviolent resistance of citizens who appealed to human rights values shared by the citizens of the European colonizers. The more recent disintegration of the Soviet Union and its puppet governments in Eastern Europe were also not the result of armed struggle. Was the result of the ongoing development of resistance within civil society in many of the countries that were part of the Soviet evil empire. The leadership of some of the nastiest of the Soviet bloc countries was simply not willing to fire on its own citizens, or the police forces and armies were not willing to do so. Again, nonviolent resistance built around shared national values and human rights led to a largely nonviolent collapse of a heavily armed totalitarian empire. One could go on. The decision of the white-dominated government of South Africa to free Nelson Mandela from decades of incarceration and negotiate a democratic transition to the majority black rule was not primarily based on an actual armed black military uprising. Again, it was the realization by the whites that there was no legitimate justification that could be made for continued minority rule. More recently, the Arab Spring saw the fall of the Tunisian and Egyptian dictators to nonviolent political protests. In Libya and Syria, where armed conflict supported the flow of weapons from outside countries has dominated, the struggle, a much bloodier conflict, took place that is nowhere near ending. Overall, it appears difficult to make the case that having a weak government and a heavily armed population that stands ready to take the law into its own hands lays the basis for a peaceful and prosperous state that values tolerance and respects human rights and individual differences. That has not been the historical experience.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.